The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dave's Gone By, an hour of talk radio, comedy, music, and whatnot coming to you live from the commutable confines of Merrick Long Island. It's our 11th show, full of statecraft and stagecraft, because 11 is one louder. I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, journalist, radio personality, theater critic, humorist, and devil's advocate. As ever, the show has a little bit of everything, although this week, politics will take center stage. My special guest is Joe Salzone, as far as I know, the world's youngest right-wing political commentator. He has a show on this very station, Saturday nights at 7:30. I was on his show a couple of weeks ago, where we argued about everything from the November elections to Henry Kissinger to Lizzie Grubman. Actually, we agreed about her, and about Kissinger, and sort of about the elections. Well, anyway, I guarantee it's going to be a lively conversation, so keep your dial here. I will caution you, as I do every week, that Dave's Gone By is a show for adults, so parental discretion is advised. That said, there's nothing here to offend children or small animals, though political animals may get an earful. We'll get to Joe Salzone later in the program, as well as some theater reviews with guest critic Charlie Gross. But first, it's the ever-popular News Gone By, which will begin right after this. Or that. Or the other. Or perhaps this. No, not that. That. Broadway. Off-Broadway. Cabaret. These are magical words conjuring up a universe of great entertainment. If you want to know everything about what's happening on the stages of New York, you need to get Performing Arts Insider magazine. For 60 years, Performing Arts Insider has been a bible of the industry. It tells you when shows are opening and closing, what they're about, who's in it, designers, writers, composers, contacts for producers and managers, box office info, parental guides, everything you need to know if you care about theater, opera, and dance too. As the chief editor of Backstage put it, Performing Arts Insider is who, what, where, and when. All the facts at your fingertips. For more information, how to subscribe or get a sample issue, call 516-295-1511 or go to www.totaltheater.com and click on Performing Arts Insider. Dave here. I want to give a plug to Don Lewis, host of Entertainment Long Island, Sunday nights at 10. It's an hour of interviews and advice about how to get started as a performer, be it for business or a hobby. Every show has trivia, nostalgia, live music by Eddie Hug and the Moonshiners, and Don's a real pro. He puts on a good show. So give a listen to Entertainment Long Island, 10 p.m. Sundays on WGBB, because the stage is a world of entertainment. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's time for the News Gone By, a look at events of the past week from a punch-drunk political perspective. Topping current events is local and national travel. New Yorkers spent the week bracing for a strike, scheduled for tonight at midnight on metropolitan subways and buses. Contingency plans were made by the mayor's office, including adding extra trains to the LIRR, and instituting a 4-passenger minimum on all cars going into the city should the strike take effect. This comes just a couple of weeks after the news that transit and rail fares are almost certain to go up next year, the unions obviously wanting a piece of that action. So far, the Transit Workers Union has lowered its demands from an 8% pay hike to 6%, while the MTA hasn't budged. That said, Manhattan's $6 billion deficit and the shaky national economy make this a rather callous time to put the screws to management, even if the union's contract does end at 12:01. Since a strike is technically illegal, Mayor Bloomberg has vowed, to sue the union and fine them heavily if there's a walkout. In response, union head Roger Toussaint said the mayor should, quote, shut up, to which Bloomberg responded, I'll shut up when I want to shut up, causing Toussaint to reply, "Don't make me come over there," with Bloomberg quickly answering back, "Yeah, you and what army?" It remains to be seen whether the dialogue will progress to the dozens, or if a mention by either party of your mama will get one of them an ass-whooping. Mayor Bloomberg did say that if the strike goes through, he'll bicycle to work, which is a lovely idea for city residents, but impractical for anyone commuting. Still, it's a fitting image. It's likely that Bloomberg started as a bike messenger, and, given the state of the economy and the job he's doing as mayor, he'll be a bike messenger again in 3 more years. Also on the transportation front, the fallout from 9/11 continues to pummel the aviation industry. This week, United Airlines filed for bankruptcy, a move that, at best, will result in job losses, wage reductions, and benefit cuts affecting some 80,000 employees. United, the world's second-largest airline, lost $2.1 billion last year and is currently losing roughly $20 million a day. And yet, the airline vows to keep flying. Glenn Tilton, CEO of United's parent company, told Newsday, quote, "We have a solid record as a safe and reliable airline, and we intend to maintain and build upon that record." Tilton added that the airline doesn't want to spook investors and customers any more than the Chapter 11 filing already has. So, instead of directly canceling flights and routes over the next year, the company will take a more optimistic approach using euphemisms. For example, an announcement at LaGuardia Airport might say, "Flight 431 to Barcelona, scheduled to leave at 2:30 p.m., is experiencing a delay of 5 to 10 years. Or, on the flight, you might hear, "Welcome to United Airlines, Flight 618 to Miami. The plane will touch down to refuel in Chicago, then make a brief unscheduled stop in Vancouver with a 3-hour layover until we reach our final destination, Los Angeles. Shuttle buses will be waiting to take you from LAX to Miami the following morning. Overall travel time, 2 days and 14 hours, though a storm in Chicago could put us off course by about 4 or 5 extra hours. Please remain in your seats with the seatbelt fastened until we're sure we have enough fuel. As soon as we give the all clear, flight attendants will be coming around with glasses of water and complimentary packets of salt and pepper for your lunch." In political news, Mississippi Senator Trent Lott made a big Mississippi this week at the 100th birthday party for retiring South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond. Lott waxed rhapsodic over Thurmond's career, especially the early years. He was quickly reminded that those early years included upholding the forced separation of whites and blacks in America. Lott apologized immediately, sort of. Then he apologized again, sort of. Then President Bush called his remarks offensive and wrong, but stopped short of saying Lott should resign as Senate Republican leader. Lott is still putting out the fires he started, and we have on tape his most recent apologia. It's kind of an infomercial mea culpa put together at the last minute, but I think he explains himself pretty clearly in this one. Let's give a listen.
"Hello, Americans. This is Trent Lott, Senator from the great state of Mississippi. And I'd like to re-clarify some comments I made last week regarding my esteemed and elderly colleague Strom Thurmond. At Senator Thurmond's 100th birthday party, I made the remark that Mississippi was proud to be a supporter of the man back in 1948. That's when he ran for president on the Dixiecrat ticket. I also said that if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years. Now, the fact that Senator Thurmond ran on a pro-segregationist ticket, and that I once lobbied to keep colored people out of my college fraternity, has been taken to mean that I am a racist. Nothing could be further from the truth. I believe in the Constitution, the one that says all men are created equal, separate, but equal. And when I said that the state of Mississippi supports Senator Thurmond's ideals, I didn't so much mean supports as privately agrees with and publicly renounces, which is every American's right. Now, I concede that I used a poor choice of words. I was insensitive. A mistake of the head, not the heart. I mean, of course it was a mistake. Would I be dumb enough to say those things out loud if it weren't a boo-boo? The people who know who I am know what I am. I've never been a member of a Klan or any racialist organization that high profile. And I have never stood in the way of progress for the colored American, the Hispano-American, the Oriental American, any of the lower cultures who want to raise themselves up to our level. I'm all for it. So, I honestly can't see what the Negroes, are getting their afros in a frizz over. We all know slavery was, well, dang it, I'll say it, slavery was wrong. And I don't care who hears me say that. And calling someone a nigger, or a coon, or a jungle bunny, or a, what's that one Senator Helms used last week? I damn near pissed myself laughing. That was, burrhead. Yeah, using those words to refer to someone whose skin color is darker than normal is all wrong. And some of the views we had back in 1948 were wrong too. But that's 50 years ago. This generation should not dwell on things that happened back when their mammies and pappies were young. This is the new Republican Party. We want to include everybody. So it's time for black people, brown people, red people, yellow people to melt into that big rainbow pot we call America. And if the ham that stirs the pot happens to be big and white, well, that's just nature. Science, even. Because if you put all the colors of the rainbow together, what happens? They turn white. It's just God's way. So I thank God for good Americans like Strom Thurmond, even if the times have changed, and what was right back then only seems right today. And I've learned my lesson. From now on, I don't make any speeches or off-the-cuff comments unless they've been proofread by two other senators and a PR expert. And by PR, I don't mean Puerto Ricans, unless I'm actually talking about Puerto Ricans, but that's very unlikely because Mississippi doesn't have any Puerto Ricans. Well, no legal ones anyway. I apologize to my president and to the American people if some of my statements caused any pain or confusion, and I hope this does not jeopardize my upcoming appointment as Senate Majority Leader. Guess it's a good thing I'm not up for Senate Minority Leader. But seriously, majority and minority, we must be a united people. We've all got to work together if we're going to stand up to the Arabs, the Pakis, the Chinese, and them pesky North Koreans. And I want to stress that colored people are absolutely welcome in the armed forces. Not behind a desk, not in the mess hall, but fighting right there on the front lines. Fighting and dying for freedom and equality in this country. I hope I've made myself clearer here today than I did last week, and I hope America will forgive this old country boy for his foolishness. I do what I do, not for myself, but for others. Thank you for your time, and God bless America. In regional news, an 80-year-old woman was mauled to death by two dogs she knew since they were puppies. The pit bulls, which will be euthanized, belong to the woman's granddaughter. According to Newsday, the woman was found covered with blood with a broken wrist and teeth and claw wounds covering 80% of her body. Asked about the incident, the granddaughter said, "I can't believe Snuggles and Dipsy Poo behaved that way. It must have been her perfume." Okay, it's time now for the obvious joke of the week. Get ready. Newsday reports that air quality officials in Southern California have officially banned the solvent perchloroethylene. Dry cleaners will have to stop using the compound, nicknamed PERC, by the year 2020. No, it's not going to be a Hugh Downs pun. Keep listening. The South Coast Air Quality Management District says long-term exposure to PERC can result in cancer to the lungs, cervix, esophagus, and bladder. Despite the findings, dry cleaners are fighting the bill, which they worry will put them out of business.
They say they don't have the money to find an alternative chemical, and that PERC is the only compound that really removes oil and grease. Okay, here comes the joke. Dry cleaners have it so hard. They work long hours, they don't make much money, and now the government wants to take away their perks! Ah, oh yeah! Oh my goodness. Did you get it? Did you see it coming? That was the obvious joke of the week, brought to you as a public disservice by Dave's Gone By. In entertainment news, magician David Copperfield stopped in the middle of a performance in Canada this week and was rushed to the hospital for a full physical examination. He's now continuing his Canadian tour, but he's also expected to submit to a battery of psychological tests, most of them starting with the question, "You let Claudia Schiffer go, why?" Finally, in medical news, a London scientist using a laptop computer, literally on his lap, noticed that after an hour, the heat from the machine caused redness and a rash to spread on his upper thighs and also burned his penis. The man had been wearing pants and underpants, or so he told Reuters. He felt a little irritation the next day, but when he visited the doctor, the physician noticed that, quote, "the ventral part of his scrotal skin had turned red, and there was a blister with a diameter of about 2 centimeters. 2 days later, the blister broke. The wounds became infected and then crusted, but after a week or so, everything healed. So, now they've started warning people to be careful of keeping laptops on our laps. But I don't know. Blame the machines all you want. I think it's the scientist's fault that he hurt his crotch. He couldn't control his hard drive, his RAM was insufficient, and he waited too long before pulling out his floppy. And that's the news gone by for December 15th, 2002. Sending your comments, opinions, and perchloroethylene barrels to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Please, no laptops. I'm already wearing hot pants. Start spreading the news. There's a new magazine in town with the latest stories and reviews about everything on stage, On and Off Magazine. It's a glossy, full-color guide to theater, dance, comedy, and cabaret in New York City. The best part is, it's free. You can find On and Off around town at theaters, restaurants, hotels, and community and information centers. Visit www.onandoffstage.com for more information, and let On and Off be your guide.
To dream the impossible dream, to find unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Let's take a step away from current events and the headaches of life for a few minutes and sail blissfully into the world of entertainment. It's a segment I like to call Dave's Gone Cultural, featuring reviews, previews, and interviews about the arts. Tonight, I'm happy to have on the phone a fellow theater critic and a friend of mine for several years now, Charlie Gross. Hey, Charlie.
How you doing, David?
Great to hear
Glad
from you.
Glad you've finally gone cultural after all these years.
Well, it's been a difficult, long haul, but I'm trying. Charlie is the co-host of a long-running theater program. How many years is it now?
I think we're in our 12th or 13th season this year. It's Two on the Isle.
Uh-huh.
If you're in Manhattan, you can see us every other Tuesday, 7:30 p.m., Channel 57.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in Bergen County, New Jersey, or at least parts of it, you can see us on Channel 98 on the Time Warner system every Monday, 10:30 p.m. If you're in either, fear not. We are now streamed live on the web every other Tuesday, 7:30, www.mnn, that's Mary Nancy Nancy, .org, then you click on Channel 57, and we're there. It's not stored, so you have to watch it live every other Tuesday, 7:30, but it's there, and even if you have a phone connection, you can see us.
Well, great. I think it's wonderful. You've been doing the show so many years, and now really not just Manhattanites can see it, but everyone. That's terrific.
And myself and Jeff Goodman, we're kind of the Siskel and Ebert of the theater.
Exactly. That's what you do. You review Broadway and off-Broadway. You do some interviews, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had, we're having Rafael Mostel. We've had in the past Sandy Duncan, Shari Lewis when she was on Broadway.
It's
Michael
a cool
Broderick.
Thing. And what we're going to do here, though, is the Siskel and Ebert thing about this is
right. Well, you have been on the show many times.
Yeah, I appreciate that, kind of returning the favor here. Mm-hmm. This is the Broadway season. This is it. Until the spring when a whole bunch of other things will open up.
Right. Just, I think the Tony the Deadline was coming up.
Right. So three big musicals I want to talk about today. And it's La Bohème, Man of La Mancha, and Dance of the Vampires, all certainly big in a production sense. Let's find out if they work also in an emotional and theatrical sense. So let's start with La Bohème, which is the opera, the Puccini opera.
Yes, and is probably better known to Broadway audiences as the musical Rent.
Well, the pre-musical.
The basis of the musical Rent. And I'll tell you, if you've seen Rent before, you've seen La Bohème, the thing that will strike you, I'm sure, is an all-white cast, and where all the characters are straight. But it is certainly the opera, and I have to say I was a little disappointed with this play.
Why is that?
I had expected incredible staging. I had expected an incredibly strong emotional draw, and it just wasn't there. I mean, the staging, the sets are beautiful.
Yeah, I think the second act set in the cafe and then all of that with all the people is marvelous.
Gorgeous. The singers, although they alternate, the ones I saw...
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, pristine voices. You know, it's the type of thing you don't really get to hear on Broadway that often. And it's nice to have something this diverse on Broadway. And, you know, it even gets a little quaint. The set is high-tech. The opera is sung in Italian, but it's got subtitles.
Right, and I think they get a little too cute with the fonts they use on the subtitles. I don't know why they do that. It's really the only distracting thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
But... Yeah, I'm still not getting quite why you were a little underwhelmed.
Well, the staging seems very static. I mean, it's respectable staging, by the director of Moulin Rouge.
Baz Luhrmann.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But certainly I had been led to believe, oh, it's innovative, it's a new interpretation, you know, whatever. And,
no, it's
you
just
know,
an
not,
intimate,
not that I'm an opera connoisseur, but, it seemed like a fairly standard type staging. And I wasn't emotionally drawn in. The show.
That would be my one real agreement with you, as much as I liked it. I wasn't terribly moved at the ending. I mean, that moment, I don't want to give away the ending to anybody who isn't familiar with La Bohème over the past 150 years, but the girl dies.
Yeah.
And that should be a really distraught, tragic moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I found other moments leading up to it touching in the first couple of acts.
Yes.
I mean, the famous ending of the first sequence is so powerful, but...
It's nicely done, but I was certainly expecting a lot more out of it.
Okay. Now, going to... away from a classic of opera to a classic of modern musicals, semi-modern musicals, Man
of La Mancha, yes, definitely a classic.
With the score by Mitch Lee and Joe Darian, the book by Dale Wasserman, who also wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They seem to revive this one every 10 years. This one now has Brian Stokes Mitchell and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio as its stars.
Don't forget Ernie Sabella.
Ernie Sabella, Sancho Panza, and what did you think?
Well, I have to say I must compliment the orchestra and the sound people. I have had so much trouble hearing the lyrics in a lot of the shows I've been seeing lately.
All right, and we'll get to Dance of the Vampires later.
Yeah, but this was so pristine, I could hear every word, even a couple of words I hadn't heard before. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. It's so nice to hear words and music that don't sound overblown, over-mic'd. It has a good Broadway live feel to it. That said...
And thank you, Tony Meola. That's the sound designer.
Yes,
and
thank you very much. Brian Stokes Mitchell, who, you know, he's an incredible singer, wonderful baritone, wonderful actor. I enjoyed his performance, but I was a little disappointed. You know, he plays Quixote as an old man, which of course he is.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the knight. This is the man who's singing the impossible dream. And I think he emphasized the old man a little too much. The knight has to shine through occasionally.
Yeah. You actually agree with John Simon there, who said that as terrific a leading man as Brian Stokes Mitchell is, I think he's one of our premier
Absolutely.
Leading men, because it's so doddering, Simon missed some of the suavity of Richard Kiley, the fellow we heard earlier when we were opening this segment.
Right.
A little bit of that grandeur. But other than that, I think Mitchell really carries it off. And what did you think of Master Antonio?
Okay, just one quick thing. About Mitchell. He carries it off, but again, the knight needs to shine through, and also he may respect the role a little too much. He doesn't let loose the way he did in Kiss Me, Kate.
Gotcha.
Mary Elizabeth was incredible. I had no idea she could sing that beautifully. And interestingly, when she, you know, she's singing her numbers, when she's singing about Aldonso's past and why she is what she is, when she's singing The Impossible Dream, her version of it, it brought tears to my eyes. She gives such a wonderful performance.
Yeah, I thought she was really a knockout in all different kinds of ways.
Right.
I did think the staging was a little clunky. I could have used a little more action as far as that goes, and rather grim in a certain sense, but the two stars, you know, untouchable. Just terrific. Quickly, let's please, we have to go to Dance of the Vampires.
Can we talk about Ernie Sabella real quick?
Go ahead. So what do we think? His Sancho Panza.
Also good, but, you know, I expect so much from Ernie, having, you know, seen him in so many other things that I was a little disappointed. He was good, but I expected him to be great.
Okay. We have one more minute. Vampires, I assume you really, really, really did not like?
Very disappointing. They're trying to be campy. It's Rocky Horror, Cats, Phantom of the Opera, all rolled up into one. Michael Crawford as the star. He's a combination of the Phantom of the Opera and Cornelius Hackle in that role. I honestly think that this show would have been a lot better if they had actually tried to play it straight. There is potential for this show, but I really think they went in the wrong direction here, despite all that beautifully grandeur scenery.
Yeah, and I think it was, I don't mind the spoofiness of it, I just thought it was too loud and too much. Otherwise, I think I would have enjoyed it a lot. Anyway, got to run, Buck.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, reminding people, Tuesday nights, 7:30, Channel 57,
right.
Time Warner Cable for Two on the Aisle.
MNN.org.
Right. Charlie, thanks so much. We'll see you on the aisle. Hi, folks. Dave Lefkowitz here from Dave's Gone By, and I want to tell you about a product, event, or service. I'm going to talk about it for half a minute or a minute. I'm going to make it really interesting, and all my listeners are going to go, hey, maybe I'll try this product, event, or service. It's called advertising or sponsorship, and it's easy, cost-effective, and just plain effective. To get your person, place, or thing, well, not thing, promoted on Dave's Gone By and reach listeners all over Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, and the tri-state area, just give us a call at 516-295-1511 or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By, and see sponsorship opportunities, ad rates, and more. Again, the number, 516-295-1511. Insert your product, event, or service here. Every Saturday night at 7:30, right here on WGBB, it's Joe Salzone Live. Tell us about it, Joe.
Well, Dave, it's a half-hour, fast-paced glimpse at the world we live in.
Joe Salzone brings his old-fashioned, conservative views, along with his desire to hear all viewpoints, to the airwaves each week. It's a one-of-a-kind show that you'll hear only on Long Island's news and information leader,
1240 AM WGBB,
the station that serves your community.
And now, get ready for the world's youngest political talk radio host.
He's 18, he's conservative,
and he's on the only station for free and independent thought.
1240 AM,
WGBB.
And now, Joe Salzone.
Well, GBB listeners will probably be quite familiar with that whole setup and that song. It's the intro to a show that's on Saturday nights at 7:30, hosted by Engineer Joe. That's what I always call him. Full name, Joe Salzone, the youngest political talk show pundit around, as far as anyone can tell, and up-and-coming and burgeoning personality on the radio and talk scene. Hello, Joe.
Hey, hey, Dave. It's strange to hear that on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
It is.
So
I'm used to hearing it on Saturdays, not Sundays.
So, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is, how did you get into radio, and also how did you get such a conservative, right-wing, kind of Hitler-esque bent?
I don't know about Hitler-esque.
Well, it's an anti-fascism song. It's nice to hear, you know, at the beginning of your show. That's right. Pretty interesting.
Right.
But,
well, a couple of years ago, I just recently celebrated my second year in radio back in November. I read an article a couple of years ago, and it basically said that of registered voters, I think 12% who were teenagers would go out and vote. And that kind of ticked me off because I've always been fascinated by politics. I've always watched the news since I was a very young guy. And I just, you know, I realized, you know, I have this ability to talk. You know, I like talking. I like debating with people. And I was offered a job at a radio station. It was a music station, but it was a chance to get my point of view across, albeit limited. My hands were tied in what I could say. But it was after my first broadcast, November 28, 2000, right in the middle of that heated election in 2000.
Yeah.
I realized after I went off the air, this is what I want to do, and I've done it since.
And have you found that when people hear your attitude and your viewpoints, I mean, do you take a lot of guff for it because most of the people around here in Long Island and New York are liberal and democratic, or do you just get a lot of the people of the great wider country who buy Rush Limbaugh's books and watch Hannity and Combs and all that stuff?
The thing about my show is that I would say about 60% of my audience is liberal, so a majority of the people who listen to me won't agree with me either way. I was bothered when I first started on radio. I was bothered by the fact that people would send me really, really cruel emails, and eventually just realized that people aren't always going to agree with you. So I've learned to deal with it. I laugh it off now. I do find myself in a position in New York, which is, you know, two of one of the most liberal states in all the country. California would be the first. I do take a lot of guff from people. Sometimes I'll laugh it off or pass it off as jealousy or envious. You know, there's a lot of envy and there's a lot of hatred towards me because I'm 18 and I've been able in 2 years to accomplish a lot in radio. I laugh it off. I don't pay attention to the critics anymore.
And also, one of the things that I do like is that you stress that you will listen on your show to all viewpoints. You do a lot of interviews. I assume you occasionally do some call-in, too.
Right.
And although you have a very specific conservative Republican agenda, you do say that you will listen to all viewpoints.
Yeah, I don't believe my side is completely right. We have some faults on our side. Every side has their faults. But every side has an argument, has a point of view, and I want to hear everyone. And I want my audience to make a decision for themselves, not based on what I say, but based on what everyone says.
Well, have you ever either been swayed to someone else's opinion, or have you ever been able to sway a Democrat or a liberal to your side?
I have swayed a couple of my friends who were hardcore, you know, Clinton supporters to my side. I don't try to convince anyone to one ideology or another. I don't like that game, and I try not to play it. What I do is I give people my side of the story and then the other side. There's always two sides of the story. We were taught that at a young age. And, again, I want people to hear all the viewpoints. That's the great thing about talk radio is that you still have the freedom to express your viewpoint without being cut off by the censors.
Right.
And make a decision for yourselves.
Well, okay, getting specifically to some of your viewpoints. I mean, we're a few weeks after the elections now, and the Republicans just kind of swept the country. I mean, I personally feel that it was more of a state-by-state thing. People voted individually in the states for the people that they preferred rather than this whole massive Republican-esque sweep. But it added up to a sweep and a sweep, ultimately,
right,
and taking Congress back and all that.
Right.
Why do you think the Republicans why did it happen that way?
Well, because the Democrats, they don't have a message anymore. They spent all their time. You know what it was? I think Americans see that there's just one party. There's the Republican Party, and then there's Republican Light, which is the Democrats.
Yeah.
You know, there is no decisiveness anymore. The Democrats have lost their identity.
Big government versus small government still? Or?
That's the basis. That's the concrete way of debating. It's, you know, Republicans, we stand for small government, low taxes. Democrats want to raise your taxes and want, you know, government intruding on your daily lives. on a much wider scale. They just ignored it. Plus, Homeland Security was a huge issue this year with this election, and Republicans have always been seen as being very strong on national defense. Liberal Democrats are seen as being anti-war,
well,
and I guess in some ways anti-American, unpatriotic.
Well,
I don't agree with that. I don't think just... I perhaps, you know, I personally believe... first of all, I was wrong in my predictions. I thought the Democrats would take back, or would keep the Senate, and would probably take back the Congress. I was wrong on that one. Thankfully, I was wrong. A lot of, I think every pundit, with the exception of one from CNN, was wrong.
And they all figured it would go in a Democratic
yeah.
way. I was figuring that too. But well, maybe you can explain this to me. This is what I don't understand. In the Clinton years, and God knows the conservatives and Republicans despise Clinton because
right.
he lied under oath and all that sort of stuff. And,
right.
But I seem to remember that the biggest thing for about a year and a half in his entire administration, the thing that everybody was worried about, was did he sleep with Monica? Yes, of course he slept with her. Did he lie about it? Why did he lie about it? All this, is he going to be impeached? Is he not going to be impeached? And that's all the country was really worrying about because the economy was pretty good. It was just before the dot-com thing really started to crash,
right.
and things were going pretty well, except for that, which the Republicans were kind of trumping up into this major issue. Fine. Over the past year and a half of the Bush administration, we've been worried about dying. We've been worried about terrorism, of fear. It's been this horrible bunch of months ahead of us that may not be directly the Republican administration's fault. Maybe it is. But why is everybody suddenly flocking to Republicans and thinking they're doing such a wonderful job when it's been horrors since Bush has been in office? Why?
Well, first of all, I disagree with you that this did not start with Bush. We've seen Al-Qaeda back in the early 90s when Clinton came into office. On three separate occasions, Bill Clinton had a chance to bring in and prosecute Osama bin Laden and chose not to, which, in my mind, ultimately led to 9/11. You can't place blame on 9/11 on anyone. The people we blame are those 19 terrorists who went aboard those four aircraft and forever changed the lives of thousands upon thousands of people in New York and Washington and that field in Pennsylvania.
Well, of course, yes.
There have been people on my side who have said, Bill Clinton, he caused it, he should be blamed, he should be tried for murder. No, he shouldn't be because it was not his fault. Just like it was not Bush's fault.
Or Bush's dad's fault, necessarily, back in the oil days.
You know, if you want to go back, you can look at Carter and his failures with foreign
policy. Well, Carter
policies.
Was a failure. There's no question about that.
You know, if you want a place to blame, we can go back to Washington. He was our first president. You know, we fought that war. Remember that? That was pretty much the first terrorism act on our country.
It's not the same.
I'm being a little, I'm exaggerating a little, but it makes my point that you can't place blame on 9/11 on any one individual. It's the fault of bin Laden and those 19 hijackers and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Well,
and all
what I'm
people.
Saying is that everybody seems to think that George Bush is doing such a fabulous job as far as this whole terrorism thing. And I'm trying to figure out, what has he done? When it first happened, he said, Osama bin Laden is public enemy number one. That's the guy we've got to get. Okay, we're still getting audio tapes from Osama bin Laden, who is somewhere. And like 2 weeks after the attacks, Osama bin Laden was no longer that important suddenly to me. It was not about him anymore. Why? Because we couldn't get him. So what is Bush doing that is so wonderful, aside from curtailing certain civil and libertarian rights in this country, for the sake of assumedly stopping terrorism?
Well, you have to admit, first of all, the war in Afghanistan went on. It was a tremendous war with little planning, with little strategy. We outed the Taliban in a matter of weeks. I think the similar thing would happen in Iraq if we eventually go in there. And by the time...
Should we go in Iraq?
Yes.
Because...
We have no choice anymore. For 4 years... Saddam Hussein has had 4 years now to do whatever he wants to with these weapons of mass destruction. We know he has chemical weapons. We know he has biological weapons. And we damn well know that if he has a nuclear weapon, he would use it against us and our allies, Israel.
Well, if he
hasn't,
let me ask you, if he has a nuclear weapon, if he has it,
yeah.
Why hasn't he used it?
Because I don't think he has one yet. But I do think he has. First of all, he's getting the materials. We know that. It's so obvious that he is. And it's so obvious that he wants it. But no, I don't think he has one. But we know we saw it in the 80s. We saw it when he invaded Kuwait, when he attacked the Kurds, when he attacked his own people, that he would use gas on mothers and children and anyone who gets in his way.
Well, I mean, the United States used Agent Orange on its own soldiers to, you know, or tested black people way back when with chemicals. That, you know,
I'm not saying America's perfect. We're not. I mean, we had slavery for crying out loud. But, you know, Saddam Hussein is a ruthless, evil dictator.
And I'm not contesting that,
right,
by the way. And I'm not even I should say that a lot of times I play, to some extent, devil's advocate, because no one more than me would like to see an anti-Semite, a murderer and a killer and a bastard like Saddam Hussein gone. I'm just kind of wondering about the consequences and the timing and all that. If we had gone in 2 months after the World Trade Center attacks and gotten Iraq then, I don't think anybody would have any question about, well, should we be doing this?
Well, because a lot of people do not see a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. There is a connection. We know.
Oh, come on. Two months after the bombings, people would just say, kill every Arab. I mean, every Arab country was sort of being, you know, any Islamic militant from everywhere. I mean, they're all over the place.
There's a connection between Iraq and 9/11. You know, somebody.
But is there a connection between Saudi Arabia, our quote unquote friend?
I think Saudi government, who, by the way, those terrorists that they support, they only do that because they know that if they don't, those terrorists will overthrow that Saudi government in a day. That'll be
Yeah, but isn't that the time for the United States to then come in and buck up the Saudi government if they're supposedly our friends? That's an excuse.
They're not our friends. They're not, and they're cozy with the Bush administration. That makes me very uncomfortable, because I think if Bush wants to be hard on terror, he would tell the Saudi government, either you stop supporting terror, or we're going to, you know, kick your ass next.
Why isn't Georgie doing that?
Because of oil. It's
you're
oil.
You're saying this.
I admit it. It's obvious. It's open. It's there. It's in the media. Yes, it's oil. It's all about oil.
Well, isn't that hypocritical just a teeny-weeny bit?
No.
Why? Why not?
Because if we overthrow Saddam Hussein, which I believe, if we go to a war in Iraq, it'll be a week. It'll be a simple war to kick Saddam out. We'd have to stay there, of course, just to stabilize a new government, just like we've done in
Iraq. Right, and understand that the terrorism repercussions would be for months after that all over the world.
You know, I mean, this war on terror is going to last forever.
Well,
it's a war between good and evil, and the rhetoric that the Republicans, and some Democrats, by the way, John Edward of North Carolina, saying how, you know, we're not going to stop until all terrorism is ended. It ain't going to happen. We live in a world where evil is a part of our daily lives. We see it every day. You turn on the news and you see someone get shot, a mother beat up a child. You see it all the time.
Yeah, I try to include a little bit of evil on my show every week,
right,
just you know, to offset that corrosive goodness.
Yeah, but you know, in a world where there's so much bad and evil, you can't lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of good too, and the media does not see that because it's not profitable, it's not marketable. You can't make money off of a good story.
Well, I don't think that's true at all. I mean, Hollywood movies have happy endings. I mean, what's the reason?
I'm talking about if you turn on the local news. And the top story is not going to be a baby found after a month of being missing. It'll be
baby missing,
a baby
dead, baby found in garbage.
Yeah, or a mother, takes her 3 or 4 year old daughter in the back of a minivan in the parking lot, the Sears,
and smacks her
around.
Yeah,
that'll be the top story.
And do you think that is what? Is that a misperception? Is that hypocrisy, or is that just the way things are? Is that goodness isn't necessarily a sniper in Washington, D.C. is more important than, you know, a lot of shopkeepers doing well during the holiday season in Washington, D.C.
It's not that it's more important. It's that more people are captivated by stories of violence and torture and mayhem. The D.C. sniper is a very good example of that. Not a lot of people would want to sit around and watch stories of mothers, you know, giving milk to their children, and, you know, all's good.
I watched
world,
that, you know, depending on
Kumbaya.
The...
Yeah,
she was cute.
They just, you know, we don't want to see that.
Okay, well, I mean, Touched by an Angel has been a successful TV show for
that's
a decade. I mean, there is an audience if that's done well.
That's it. I mean, the station has some good quality, you know, old-fashioned family programming, which is slowly dying in this country because we're focusing now on sex and violence and blood and lust. You see it on these stupid, goofy teen shows on Channel 11 and 9.
Well, are you going to blame that on liberals and Democrats,
no,
too, or is that just
no,
what people watch?
It's a shift in our society. I do think it is the fact that liberal policy in this country has contributed to a generation of sissies. You know, there have been stories...
Sissies,
you,
dude?
Yeah, you can't play tag in schools anymore because a child's feeling might get hurt if they lose. That's insane.
Wow.
That is insane.
That is insane.
That
although,
is,
you know, I remember being picked second to last in, like, pretty much every sport in school.
So was I. It didn't hurt my feelings.
Then you're doing out of a hat, you know?
I'm a bad athlete. I don't hide it.
Yeah, and gym was a fairly miserable experience half the time for half the kids
right.
in school.
And it's, so, you know, if one thing that I will never like about a liberal, and I don't want to generalize, but this is a majority of them, and I have a lot of liberal friends, they are so touchy-feely, and I hate that.
You mean physically touchy-feely, or they're just
well,
what? They're like,
well, Clinton was physically touchy-feely.
Well, yeah.
You know, they're so, you know, look, well, let's talk it out. You know, like Columbine, when those two kids shot up 13, 14 people.
Right. I don't think they were liberals.
They had emotional problems. They might have been abused.
And their fathers
had
guns.
You know, in my eye, they are evil, psychotic people who lost their mind and shot people and I hope are burning in hell.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's...
But liberals, they want to make excuses for people. They don't want to hold people accountable for their actions. They want to hold other people. It's never... I'll use Al Gore as an example. He lost in 2000. It wasn't his fault. No, it was the voters' fault. Or it was his campaign workers' fault. It was, that Florida government, that's corrupt there. It's not his fault. It's not his fault that he's
I do agree with your whole bent of people taking responsibility for their own actions and... leaving people who, when you see someone is responsible for something, not letting them off the hook by saying, oh, it's this and this and this. I do think you're overgeneralizing about liberals and Democrats by saying that they only feel that way, when
I'm
in fact the idea is to get at root causes of certain things, like poverty or whatever it is, or crime, and to say, you know, if we change this over a long period of time, if we change the class structure of the country, if we change the opportunities that people have, well, then maybe... we won't have this crime factor. It isn't so much of, let's not blame him, it's let's try and change the system so that they have more opportunities to do other things. I mean, that is, I guess, a smarter democratic liberal viewpoint or whatever it is.
Well, that, I mean, I guess you would be the new Democrat, the centrist, not the
liberal. I don't know
who
I am, yeah. I never consider myself a liberal except in artistic and matters like that. And that's where I come down very... I mean, you're a radio guy.
Right.
And you should feel free to say what you want to say.
And I do, and I'm happy that, and we live in a country where you're able to speak your mind.
Well, if you were pro... Heaven forbid, but if you were pro-Al-Qaeda, if you were sort of anti-American, but not to the point of treason, do you think you should be allowed to vent your views? Do you think Donald Rumsfeld should okay that?
It depends on the circumstance, and I'll tell you why. We're living in a different time now. We're living in a war time. Not many of us will see this again.
I hope.
So do I. I don't want to. You know, I don't want to wake up and see another 9/11. I do think in a time of war, you have to give up some of your rights in order to protect yourself. I said it after 9/11. I got into a lot of trouble with a lot of people by saying on air, and I got a lot of phone calls about this, that in a time of war, I am more than willing to give up some of my civil liberties and my rights to protect myself and my family from another 9/11.
For how long?
Until you know, we're safe again. And it may never be again.
But who decides what rights you give up?
I don't think it should be the government, because that would be big government. And like I said in the beginning, I don't want big government at all.
So individuals should be able to determine for themselves what rights they give up?
I think so. I think if a person decides that they want to give up some of their rights, they should.
It should be like a voluntary rights system. People fill out a card that they give back to the government. I voluntarily give up the right to say the F word on the air. That's mine.
I would be more than willing to give up that word.
Well, whatever. But I'm just saying. But the guy next door, he doesn't want to give up his right to own a firearm.
And he has a right to do that. You know, again, we live in a country where you do have the ability to speak your mind, no matter how idiotic your position is or how unreasonable and how unrealistic it is. I don't think disagreeing with the president makes you un-American. I don't that generalization. I think, if anything, I think dissent is what America's about. It's about debate. It's about, you know, I think someone once said to me, debating the issues keeps America strong.
But isn't that a liberal Democrat thing?
No.
And then Republicans,
that's
just,
a common
they don't
sense.
Debate and then they go and do.
That's a common sense thing. That's a lesson in life. That's not a political lesson. That's a life lesson.
Well, one life lesson to take from this conversation is you've got to listen on Saturday nights at 7:30 to Joe Salzone Live. I want to thank him for being my special guest on this Dave's Gone By.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave. It was a lot of fun.
Great fun talking to you. I hope actually we do this again. I think we definitely have lots to talk about.
We'll have to.
Excellent. Thanks. If you're a big fan of Dave's Gone By, and I know I am, why not join the Bystanders, the official Dave's Gone By fan club? Because you can receive a bi-monthly newsletter, get a weekly special email, an autographed membership card, eligible for discounts on show merchandise and local businesses, receive a one-hour best-of audio tape, including favorite moments from the show, and maybe even stuff we couldn't put on the radio. All this for just $10. For the newsletter, the discounts, the email, and the collector's item audio tape, it's a great deal. And if you join before March 31st, we'll throw in a signed picture of the host. Just make a $10 check or money order payable to Total Theater and send it to Total Theater, Box 62, that's 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. You can also join via PayPal to the email address davesgoneby@aol.com. That's davesgoneby@aol.com. I didn't want to end this edition of Dave's Gone By without giving a couple of birthday nods. Ludwig von Beethoven and Noel Coward, both born tomorrow, December 16th. Born December 18th, Keith Richards and Steven Spielberg. And, ironically enough, sharing a birthday Saturday, December 21st, Joseph Stalin and Frank Zappa. Well, they do share some characteristics. Musicians who worked with Zappa often said he could be dictatorial, even tyrannical. Politically, of course, there is no resemblance. For Stalin, free will was a menace to the state, a threat to be extinguished by every means possible. Zappa represented personal freedom and individuality to a degree that would have been extreme were it not balanced by a strong morality and a mind-boggling work ethic. The individual versus corrupt society is a theme that ran through Zappa's work for 30 years till his death on December 4th, 1993. Can you believe it's been 9 years? Anyway, here's an early example of Zappa's moral indignation, a pretty uncharacteristic track, in fact, as it's more finger-pointing than satirical, and the music is a straightforward rock riff rather than the R&B he was spoofing at the time, or the twisted jazzy stuff he'd get into later on. But it still gets ya. It's off the first album, Freak Out, and it's called Trouble Coming Every Day.
Well, I'm about to get upset from watching my TV, checking out the news. I tell my eyeballs fail to see. I mean to say that every day is just another rotten mess. And what's gonna change, my friend, is anybody's guess. So I'm watching and I'm waiting, hoping for the best. Even think I go to praying every time I hear them saying that there's no way to delay that trouble coming every day. No way to delay that trouble coming every day. Wednesday I watched a riot, I seen the cops out on the street. Watched them throwing rocks and stuff and choking in the heat. Listened to reports about the whiskey passing round. Seen the smoke and fire and the market burning down. Watched while everybody on your street would take a turn. The stomping, smashing, bashing, crashing, slashing, busting, burn. And I'm watching and I'm waiting, hoping for the best. Even think I go to praying every time I hear them saying that there's no way to delay that trouble coming every day.
no way to delay that trouble coming every day. You can cool it, you can heat it, 'cause baby I don't need it. Take your TV tube and eat it, and all that phony stuff on sports, and all the unconfirmed reports. You know I watch that rotten box until my head began to hurt from checking out the way the newsmen say they get the dirt before the guys on channel so.
Well, they might have named the song The More Things Change. That's Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, circa 1965, Trouble Coming Every Day. Well, thank you for coming this day to my show, Dave's Gone By. Check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By, to see a playlist for the music on this and previous programs, plus photos, archives, all sorts of stuff. Learn more about the Bystanders Club, advertising, sponsorship, and helping this show get better and bigger every week. Thank you, Station Manager Joey, Engineer Paul, Joe Salzone, my special guest. Listen to his show, Joe Salzone Live, Saturday nights at 7:30. Thanks to Charlie Gross for his theatrical banter. Catch him and Jeff Goodman in Two on the Isle, Tuesdays at 7:30, on Time Warner's Channel 57, or streaming on the web at MNN.org. Sunday nights, an hour from now, 10 to 11, don't miss Don Lewis, hosting Entertainment Long Island about how to be a performer. Thanks to my assistant and wife, Joyce Weil. Good luck on Thursday, knock 'em dead. Happy belated birthday to her mom. And, oh, Bobby, how could you? Congratulations to David and Cheryl Pace of Brooklyn, New York, winners of the Broadway and Beyond CD from our contest last week. They'll be whistling all the way to the post office, God help them. And that's Dave's Gone By for this week. 11 is one louder. Please send your comments, suggestions, and Trent lotteries to davesgoneby@aol.com. Tune in next Sunday at 8. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Get on your bike. And gone by. And God and soul went with spring. Never, ever, never, ever get so old again.
You've been listening to Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz on 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. Sweet things.